Egypt this week seemed to be both poised to truly enter the 21st century and plunge back to 1980. As protests have swelled, the Egyptian government methodically shut down almost all of the country's cell phone and internet connections. All of the digital nerves that connect Egyptians to each other and Egypt to the world, email, mobile phone calls, and social networks, were suddenly severed and with astonishing ease, though there are reports that some service has returned today. There are apparently only four internet service providers in Egypt, so just a few phone calls from the government were all that were required to make phones go dead and screens go dark. The United States, by contrast, has thousands of internet routes and providers. That can be maddening when you're trying to get a question about your monthly bill resolved, but a central shutdown here is unthinkable, if not impossible. If the Egyptian government hoped that shutting down mobile phones, email, text messages, Twitter, and Facebook would close Egypt off from the world and choke the cries of protest, they were as naive as powerful people who sit in palaces surrounded by armies can be. Citizens were past tweeting and flickering anyway and took to the streets. A confident popular regime doesn't try to keep its citizens in the dark, and they picked up a scent of fear in the government's repression. Professor of Engineering at Cairo University named Omar Mohammed joined the protest this week. As he told one of our reporters, the regime used fear to control our nation for decades. That fear is gone right now. In a country as free as ours, information is so free we can forget how precious and powerful it is. But authoritarian governments know that news, and even the nonsense and misinformation that goes with it, can be insurrectionary. That's why they try to hold news back, contain it, strain it, and dole it out to their citizens after it's been sugarcoated, like treats to obedient children. It would be comforting to say that suppressing news and information never works. In fact, it often works well enough for countries to spend decades under one kind of authoritarian regime or another. But the instinct for people to connect is strong. And these days it can span oceans as well as neighborhoods. Governments can try to take it away, but if they do, people still take to the streets. And you're listening to NPR News. Sports fans love and live by bromides. You'll hear a lot of them in these days leading up to the Super Bowl. Game is won or lost on the line of scrimmage. Field position, that's the game. They're going to call a timeout now to ice the kicker, etc. Now another University of Chicago economist has tried to apply some tenets of economic analysis to sports. That is, colleague Steve Levitt applied to the larger world with Freakonomics. Tobias Moskowitz, a behavioral economist and professor of finance at the University of Chicago, and John Wertheim, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, have written a new book, Scorecasting: The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Are Played and Games Are Won. Tobias Moskowitz and John Wertheim join us from New York. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let me begin with you first, Professor Moskowitz. Your line of thinking begins with when you folks were together at summer camp.
Right. We go way back, and we grew up in Indiana, met at summer camp in Michigan. He was at Bloomington. I was in West Lafayette. So we were obviously college basketball fans, but for rival teams. We've always had a love of sports and remained friends for many years.
Yeah, we're coming up to the Super Bowl, of course, and there is no home field advantage. But I'm fascinated by the section in the book where you folks suggest there is such a thing as home field advantage, but not for the reasons a lot of us think.
Home teams get different calls than visiting teams. And we looked at...
From the referees.
From the impartial officials. From the impartial officials. And we looked at all sorts of data, how balls and strikes are called. We looked at replay and whether calls were being overturned in the NFL, red cards in soccer. And what we saw in a variety of sports in a variety of contexts was that officials were simply calling the game differently for the home team versus the road team. And when the games were closer, that difference expanded, and when they knew they were being monitored, when there were cameras or whether there was replay, that difference ironically went down, and it just became pretty clear to us that this is where the home field advantage really resides.
But officials are flown in from all over now, right?
what we think is at the root of this is social psychology, that people are influenced by group opinion. In sports is when the officials are calling things in favor of the home team, it's not on the obvious calls. You know, a pitch right down the middle of the plate, that's an obvious call. It's a strike. They don't try to give that to the home team. But when the pitch is uncertain, when it's on the corners, when you're not sure whether it's a strike or a ball, they tend to call it with the home crowd. And part of it is the home crowd, of course, is biased, and they see it in the home team's favor. And we think that influences the referees.
And nothing subversive. We don't think these refs are on the take, but it's just sort of a basic human nature.
There's a bromide in football that when there's about to be a field goal attempt, the defensive team will call a timeout to so-called ice the kicker to make him nervous. You say that's useless.
The data does not suggest that that's an effective strategy. But again, this goes back to a theme that sort of recurred, which is basically, risk, reward and perception and coaches wanting to save their jobs. And if you make that field goal, the obvious response from the fans and sports talk radio is, why didn't he call a timeout to ice the kicker? Empirically, there's very little to support that, but that's still guy lines up to kick the field goal and the coaches call a timeout. And the irony of that is sometimes it even gives the kicker sort of a dress rehearsal that he can go ahead and kick the ball and it doesn't count and he can gauge the wind.
In fact, what I always find funny is that now it's almost expected that you'll call a timeout to ice the kicker. So kickers expect it. So, I think the right play might actually be not to do it. They might throw the kicker off. John's right. We looked very hard in the data to try to find any effect from this and just couldn't. We actually even applied the same sort of analysis to basketball where you see people try to ice the free throw shooter.
You think teams punt too much on fourth down?
You know, one way to think about it is, what's the expected number of points you'll get from any play? Another way to look at it is I got frustrated last week. I was watching the Bears game.
Lot of us got frustrated watching the Bears game, but I digress,
And just to give you an example, they were, I think, in Green Bay territory around the 40-yard line or so. Can't kick a field goal from there. Fourth, I think, in a couple of yards, 3 or 4 yards. Yeah. And, of course, they punt. Now, what happens when they punt? The most likely outcome, which is exactly what did happen, is it went into the end zone. And the Packers got it at the 20. So they gained something like 15 yards for giving it up on fourth down versus going for it. Even if they had failed, they would have been only slightly worse off, 15 yards. And they had a very good chance, perhaps, of making it and prolonging that drive. And those are the things that can be difference makers.
I was a little disappointed to read in the book that you, Tobias Moskowitz, big name economist, you believe in randomness and even luck.
We as human beings have a very hard time understanding randomness and luck. And I think where we see this most evident are in streaks, so-called momentum or the hot hand, the idea being that means they're going to keep continuing to do well. The reality is when you look at the data, it's all pretty much consistent with randomness. And the great example that I like to show people is, look, if you flip a coin 100 times, right, it's a random event. But that doesn't mean you won't get 6 or 7 heads in a row at some point. Does that mean that there's a streak, that there's momentum in coin flipping? No, of course not. It just means that whenever you have random occurrences, you can get streaks just by chance. People don't like to attribute that to sports, but when you look at the data, you can't refute that it's not just random. And I know that's controversial, certainly that's the data that we found. And that was true in almost every sport.
But Professor Moskowitz, let me pose the question that you folks take up in your last chapter. Why haven't the Chicago Cubs won a World Series in 150 years? All right, not 150, but 110.
That's a pretty bad streak. I agree. I think it has more to, I think there are some other elements besides just randomness there. One thing we talk about is economic incentives. So with the Cubs in particular, we looked at how attendance moves with winning and losing percentage. Yeah. And for the Cubs, it's perfectly stable. There seems to be no rhyme or reason to it. They're always at 90%+ capacity, whether the team's in first place or last place. Fans, in some sense, impose an incentive on the team to produce wins by either showing up for the game or not when they're losing. And that doesn't seem to happen at Wrigley.
Tobias Moskowitz, a behavioral economist and professor of finance at the University of Chicago, winner of the Fisher Black Prize for Finance Scholarship, and L. John Wertheim, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Their new book, Scorecasting: The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Are Played and Games Are Won. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
And to read an excerpt from Scorecasting, you can go to our website, npr.org.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. One of the clearest and quite possibly best descriptions of commodity trading can be found in the film Trading Places. In it, Eddie Murphy plays a homeless street hustler named Billy Ray Valentine. He's brought in to work for a stuffy Philadelphia commodities firm named Duke & Duke. In this scene, Valentine is brought into a conference room where what appears to be a breakfast spread is laid out on a table.
No thanks, guys. I already had breakfast this morning.
This is not a meal, Valentine. We are here to try to explain to you what it is we do here.
We are commodities brokers, William. Commodities are agricultural products, like coffee that you had for breakfast, wheat, which is used to make bread, pork bellies, which is used to make bacon, which you might find in a bacon and lettuce and tomato sandwich. And then there are other commodities like frozen orange juice and gold. Though, of course, gold doesn't grow on trees like oranges.
It's no coincidence that this is one of Emily Lambert's favorite films. She covers the Chicago commodities markets for Forbes magazine, and she's just written a new history of how those markets came about. It's called The Futures, and in it, Emily Lambert explains why it all started in the Windy City.
Chicago's weather is horrible, especially in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. If you've been, I'm sure you know, there are all kinds of things that could be blamed on it, and one of them is futures contracts, because what people needed to do at that time, especially in the grain business, was they grew grain, and then they needed to get it to Chicago to sell, and they did that by traveling on the river. And then the river would freeze up, and they couldn't get their grain to Chicago, and there was a delay, and during that delay, there was a risk that the price of grain was going to fall. So the first reason is the weather. And the second reason is that Chicago at that time was a boom and bust kind of town. It was growing like mad. Basically, there were a lot of people in the city who were looking for opportunities and looking to make their fortunes and looking to take risks.
This was a time where you sort of had the emergence of the pit, right? Now, I think a lot of people would, and forgive me for this because I'm jumping ahead decades and I'm jumping into fiction, but I think a lot of people think of Trading Places, right? The film that takes place in these exchanges where you've got these guys, and is it Green Jackets or Yellow Jackets? I can't remember, shouting all around, I'm in the pit.
102 men for 100 days old!
And describe what happens inside the pit.
Your description is right on. The color of the jacket actually depends on the exchange. The pit is an octagonal area where there are raised steps. So it was crammed with men, and they looked at each other, and that's where they made deals.
This is before computers came around, right?
This is before computers came around, and the pits do still exist, although they are not as full by any means as they once were.
You describe the way a person would get a job at one of these exchanges back in the mid-20th century, even into the 80s, a system where you were vouched for by somebody else. How did that work?
So to be a trader, you had to be a member. And in order to be a member, you had to have other members vouch for you. It was very much like a country club.
It was club, yeah.
Yep. And there was very much a progression of how somebody learned the trading business. You might start off as a runner, taking slips of paper from traders who were making deals in the pits in the frenzy of the trading atmosphere and running it to the back office. And then you might graduate to working on the phone, taking orders from people calling in. And then you might become a broker who was in the pit, or a trader trading for yourself in the pit. And then you might vouch for somebody else and help them get their membership.
You describe so brilliantly the differences in culture that sort of began to emerge between the people who worked at the Chicago Board of Trade and those who worked at the Merck. And those differences still exist to this day. But I want to ask you about the culture of these two places, because there's a line in your book that just stands out. It says, if your first name was Murray, you went to work for the Merck. But if your last name was Murray, you went to work for the Chicago Board of Trade. Can you explain what that means?
Yes. The Chicago Board of Trade was identified most closely with the South Side Irish community of Chicago. And the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, a few blocks away, was predominantly Jewish. And the characters of the places, without a doubt, were There was the Irish exchange and there was the Jewish exchange.
Was there a sense among people who worked in one exchange or the other that this was the better exchange? Did the people who worked in either exchange think that about their own exchange?
Oh, what a funny question. Yes, they very much thought that. There was a tremendous rivalry between these exchanges. And the Chicago Board of Trade for a very long time was the dominant exchange. It was the futures market. And the Chicago Merck was the scrappy, younger, annoying sister to the Chicago Board of Trade.
There was a time when the futures market was banned in onions. This happened in the mid-50s, and it involved a man named Vincent Kosuga. Tell me the story about that.
He was around in the 1950s when onion futures were traded at the Chicago Merck. And I would hear things about Vince Kosuga, like Vince Kosuga would show up on the floor and bring his gun, and he liked to flew planes and flew one into the ground and then walked out of the hospital like nothing had happened. All these
this guy was
outlandish
kind of legendary.
Yes. And frankly, I didn't want to put some of these in the book because I wasn't sure if they were true or not. And then I met his nephew, who is a trader, who told me that, oh, absolutely, they're all true. And in fact, he had more of them. But this was Vince Kosuga. Vince Kosuga was a New Yorker, a farmer. He grew onions, among other things. And he started trading onion futures at the Chicago Merck. And he and his broker artificially drove up the price many times, not just them, but they got caught for it. And Congress banned onion futures, and it became the first futures contract ever to be banned. And in fact, the definition of a commodity until recently was anything but onions.
Emily Lambert, in the book you say the futures business was quickly corrupted. How would you describe the state of it today?
Futures markets were quickly corrupted at the beginning, but over the next couple of decades, they became regulated markets. And the markets thereafter worked reasonably well. But now there are also related derivatives markets. And those derivatives markets were, one might say, like the futures markets in Chicago in the 1800s. So what's happening now is that it's almost like we're living back in Chicago in the 1800s, and we're hammering out the kinks of the market so that the markets will continue to function.
That's Emily Lambert. She's author of the new book, The Futures, The Rise of the Speculator and the Origins of the World's Biggest Markets. She's also a senior writer at Forbes magazine. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
We can expect to hear a lot about corporate taxes over the next few years. In his State of the Union address, President Obama said the current tax system is broken.
Those with accountants or lawyers to work the system can end up paying no taxes at all. But all the rest are hit with one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world. It makes no sense, and it has to change.
Just how broken is the corporate tax system? We asked NPR's Brett Neely to find out.
For an example of what the president was talking about, consider the tax rate paid by two of America's biggest companies, Walmart and General Electric. Walmart paid 34 cents for every dollar of profit it made in the past 3 years. General Electric paid just 3.6 cents on the dollar. Welcome to the mysterious world of the corporate income tax, says tax expert Len Berman at Syracuse University.
They're big companies that consider their tax departments to be profit centers.
That's right. Instead of concentrating on making light bulbs, power plants, or whatnot, companies use the tax system to boost their profits. How do they do it? Berman says it helps to be large and have lots of overseas subsidiaries.
They make money by moving income overseas or in different kinds of activities or adjusting their accounting in such a way that they can pay less taxes than their competitors do.
Companies say their behavior is driven by the fact that corporate taxes here in the U.S. are among the highest in the world. True, but there are other ways to look at it, says Robertson Williams of the Tax Policy Center in Washington.
If you look at the statutory tax rate, the 35% tax rate, we're among the highest among industrialized countries. If you look at the effective tax rate, the actual tax rate that companies pay after all the adjustments they make, we're much closer to the center of the pack.
That's around 25% or so. And when companies work aggressively to minimize their U.S. taxes, they leave billions of dollars in profits parked overseas. Economist Len Berman says, think about a company that moves its pharmaceutical plant from New Jersey to Ireland for tax purposes. In addition to the loss of American jobs, there are other costs to consider.
The company might say, well, it's worth incurring the transportation costs of hauling all the medicines back overseas from Ireland to the U.S. because of all the money they save on taxes. But that's just a pure waste.
Pharmaceutical and biotech companies pay some of the lowest tax rates around, in the low single digits, according to research from New York University. Most retailers, like Walmart, pay the full 35% corporate tax rate. Rochelle Bernstein is the tax counsel for the National Retail Federation.
Right now, we have the tax code that provides incentives for you to do this type of behavior or that type of behavior. The better way to do it, lower the rates, broaden the base, and let businesses make the right decisions without the tax code getting in the way.
The difference is because Congress has showered the pharma and biotech industries with tax write-offs for research and development. Meanwhile, energy companies get tax breaks for exploration. But retailers and many companies that don't do much business overseas tend to get very few write-offs. President Obama didn't lay out a detailed plan for reforming the corporate tax in his State of the Union speech. He said only that he wants to weed out the loopholes so that overall rates can be lower for everyone while raising the same amount of money. There is a precedent for the kind of tax reform he's proposing. Back in 1986, President Reagan reached a deal with Congress that cleaned out many loopholes. Syracuse's Len Berman says that deal actually raised corporate taxes quite a bit, while lowering individual tax rates.
There was a turning point when a bunch of corporate CEOs came to Washington and said, well, we really like this proposal, even though you're going to hammer our companies, because we personally are going to pay a whole lot less in income tax.
But in the current fiscal environment, there may not be enough money to buy off CEOs with yet another round of tax cuts. Brett Neely, NPR News, Washington.